If you were listening Friday night, I was filling in for George Norrie, and I mentioned that I thought that this is the year, the 50th anniversary of the Beatles that we know anyway, the Fab Four with Ringo joining the band, and sure enough, it is. It is the 50th anniversary of Ringo and the first hit. I thought it was Please Please Me. One of my astute listeners pointed out that was not released until the following year. So, but the first song that came out was in October of 1962, Love Me Do. That was their first hit. And I'm just wondering, where's the hoopla? 50 years of Beatles, that's pretty much most of my life. And you'd think there'd be a documentary and TV specials and a centennial album, or I mean, some sort of a celebratory album or something. Maybe we'll see that later in the year, but we're certainly going to be playing Beatles songs all the way through the rest of this year, at least when I'm hosting. We're talking with David Politis about his new book, Missing 411, two-volume set about strange disappearances in national forests and national parks. We'll finish up the conversation about his ability to develop sources within the National Park Service, and then we jump right into the cases, and we're going to cover a heck of a lot of them. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. All right, David, before the break, I was asking you whether you succeeded in developing any confidential sources who had worked for the Park Service, and you were telling me about one particular cluster. Pick up the story from there.
So this is in Crater Lake, and a document that we discovered talked about one of the park rangers that had found a body out in the middle of the wilderness after this 19-year-old kid had disappeared. Again, this guy's name was Charles McCullough. He visited the lake by himself. Went there to photograph it during the winter. This happened in February of 75, and he disappeared. And at the time, his dad was on the East Coast, came out to Crater Lake, looked around, had the help of the Park Service, and was completely befuddled that his son could disappear in this lake at that time. And Crater Lake, imagine it as a giant volcano filled with water. You can't go down to the lake during the winter. The sides are very steep. There's 20-foot drifts of snow. It's a absolutely gorgeous place, but dangerous at the same time. So we found the name of a ranger. His name was Marion Jack, and Marion was a science teacher outside of Medford during the school year. And at the end of the school year, he went to the Law Enforcement Training Academy for the feds, became a law enforcement park ranger, and every summer he would take his family up to Crater Lake, and they would live there for the summer, and he was one of their law enforcement officers. Well, when McCullough disappeared, McCullough's dad came out, and he described for the Park Service the things that Charles should have with him. And there were some unusual things. First of all, there was a lot of camera equipment, a small backpack, a key for a Volkswagen, a very distinct type of Volkswagen key, and some other things. Well, a little more than a year after Charles disappears, about 12 miles from the point where he was at the lake, in the middle of the wilderness, and I mean in the middle of nowhere, some hikers are in a box canyon where a small creek goes in, and they see what they think is a skeleton. They eventually make their way out, and they bring some stuff with them that they found in the area, and what they found was a backpack, and they opened the backpack with the help of Marion and some other rangers, and they find this key, and right away they know that this is McCullough. So Marion, one of his jobs was to bring his horses up there for the summer, and he was one of the equestrian rangers, and so him and another ranger ride into this site, and he describes it as a long, rigorous, tough ride to get back in there. And making note, he said in February of 75, there were special notes in the report that there were 20-foot drifts of snow around the perimeter of the lake, making it literally impossible for anybody to get into the wilderness from the point that McCullough disappeared. Where he was found was in a canyon sort of thing with a small creek, not a big creek, very small, that ran in. And he said, I walked up to it. I ended up finding Marion, who lives in southern Oregon, absolutely the greatest guy in the world, the kind of person you'd want being a park ranger. And he said, Dave, phenomenal that you were asking me about this case, because in 30 years of doing this, this is the strangest event I ever saw in my life. He says, myself and another guy walked into the canyon, and there was a large Douglas fir tree kind of branching the creek. And we walked up to it, we kind of looked over the other side, and on the other side was a sight I'll never forget. And he said, imagine, Dave, that you're standing up and you melted into your jeans, your blue jeans. And he said, what we looked at was even more amazing, and that was, is that the jeans were sitting down on the bank, just like you would melt into them, except a more unusual sight. The pants were unbuttoned, and the belt was undone. And he said, the socks were inside the jeans as though they should be, and there were small bones in the socks as there should be, and there was one tibia on the right leg, that's the bone between the knee and the foot, which was broken, and there were no other bones. And he says, but a more disturbing sight, Dave, was that there were no boots. And he says, I've recovered dozens and dozens of bodies in the middle of the woods, and we always find the boots, because the boots don't blow away, animals don't take the boots, and there's something that can last 100 years. He says, but there's no boots. And he said, but the pants were there, but there's no shirt, there's no boots, there's no coat, there's no camera. He was carrying a knife, there's no knife, there's no nothing, except these small bones and a bone from a right knee. So in a circular pattern moving out from that area, they found the top of his skull 12 feet away. And a series of small bones, probably no bigger than an inch in circumference, around the entire area. Now Marion says, Dave, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Something's wrong here. First of all, how McCullough got to this location in the middle of winter makes no sense. And what he's looking at right there makes zero sense. So what the rangers are taught to do in rural areas is call for an FBI ERT team, and that's an evidence response team, and they come from either Eugene or they come from Portland. So they secure the scene, they radio for an ERT team to come in and work this scene. So the FBI responds by helicopter with a group, and they end up working the scene for 4 days, Marion says. And he says, I know that the agents were befuddled, and everyone was wondering what was going on. And he goes, there were never really any good answers, Dave. But he says, FOIA the FBI and get the report. So I FOIA the FBI, and they send me some redacted report where you couldn't read 25 words on the whole page. And then they wouldn't send me the report on the crime scene or the crime scene diagrams. And what they did, and they do this every time, is they say that it would violate the privacy rights. I said, now, wait a minute. The person's dead. What privacy rights are we concerned about here? And the guy says, hey, that's our policy. You're not going to get it. Said, okay. So hold that thought for a minute regarding the open pants and the zipper down and the belt buckle undone. And if that's not strange enough, you would probably never hear this next point again in your life. So I asked Marion, I said, Marion, what do you make of this? She says, David, it makes no sense to me. The kid couldn't have gotten there in the middle of winter as far as we're concerned. He didn't have any snowshoes. He didn't have any skis. He didn't have anything for winter. And even if he did, I don't think he could have made it that far into the wilderness in the winter. There's no way. I says, okay. So during this three-year search, son of a gun, if I don't come across a case equally as bizarre with the same sort of elements that I'm talking to you about here, and that is in the Great Smoky Mountains, a kid disappears, a Boy Scout, he's on a trip through the Smokies, ended up getting fallen behind and disappears. They search for him for a week, week and a half. Nobody can find him. Dogs can't search. They can't find him. It snows. And in the middle of a river, now this is a big, pretty big sized river, searchers are next to the river and they see a rock out in the middle, and there's a backpack laying on the middle of the rock, as though somebody's taking inventory of things in the backpack. He goes, there's everything right there. And they can't figure this out because nobody in their right mind or even in their wrong mind would go in that river in the middle of winter. So they search and they don't find anything. A couple more days later, they search a little more and further upstream, further into the wilderness in the middle of nowhere, they find this kid leaning against a tree. He doesn't have any shoes on. Doesn't have a coat on, doesn't have a shirt on, and his pants are unbuckled, and they're pulled down to his knees. Now, asking the Park Service what they make of this, the common theme is, well, some people, when they suffer hypothermia, they take their clothes off. So I talked to some people that have been to the Himalayas. I said, how many climbers do you know of that have stripped naked when they get hypothermia? They laughed, and they said, you're insane. I said, well, there's this theory going on out here in certain search and rescue circles that people do this when they get really cold, and they suffer hallucinations, and they actually get hot, and they take their clothes off. I go, hey, we don't see that here. Okay, well, maybe in some bizarre way, people get really hot, and they take their clothes off. Why would you drop your pants?
That's very strange. Since you're into the discussion of cases, let's start with the first one you mentioned in the book, and you already made a reference to it. This is something that happened in the Yukon Territory, and it's one of the cases that really got you hooked on it.
Yeah, Bart Schleyer. Bart was a guy who is a mountain man to the max, but he's a smart guy. He was raised in the woods. His dad was a physician, but took Bart all over the world to Africa hunting. He ended up working for the state of Montana in their bear program, tagging and releasing bear. He was in phenomenal condition. He actually went to Russia at one point and helped them tag and release bear. If there was anybody out there that was going to survive in the woods under any condition, it was Bart. And he always would look for more and more challenges. And he ended up going to the Yukon and the capital up there called White Horse. And this happened to be a story that riveted me because I've been to the Yukon a number of times. And it's very remote in certain regions. There's not a lot of ground cover in certain areas. Some areas of the Yukon have great fishing. Some have no fish. Some areas have lots of moose. Some have no moose. And Bart went to an area and was flown in. He set up a camp, brought supplies. And Bart would never hunt with a gun. In North America, he always hunted with a bow and arrow. And he set up on the other side of the lake, and it appeared as though he was hunting for moose. Now, at about this time, I told a buddy of mine that owns a lodge up in the Yukon. I said, hey, do you know anybody in the western region of the Yukon that worked for natural resources? And my buddy of mine was a hunting and fishing guide, and he said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. And he put me onto a man that had worked in the Yukon for 35 years, and son of a gun, he was on Schleyer's crime scene, and they put me in touch with him. This guy said, Dave, son of a gun, 35, you hear this more and more, but he says, son of a gun, that's the strangest scene I've ever been in my life. He goes, where did you ever hear about this? I told him, you know, it's through some work. Some friends told me that Bart had disappeared, and they were concerned. He said, concerned, this is one of the most peculiar cases I'm ever going to tell you about. He said, we got there because the pilot pulled up to pick Bart up and couldn't find him. And he had the creeps. And he left and he told RCMP. So the RCMP come in there and they did a superficial job and left, like less than an hour and a half. Yeah, they saw his stuff. Nothing was disturbed. The food was still there. Bears didn't attack the food. Nothing. They couldn't find him and they left. Some of Bart's friends pay for a guy to fly him in there. And what they found disturbed them so much that they left. They got a contingent of RCMP, came back, and started to search the scene. So what happened was the search shows that Bart was probably sitting on this utility bag up near a tree, probably with his bow and arrow, waiting for a moose, calling it in. And somehow or another, something took him from behind. That's the assumption. So he was wearing a baklava over his head, and the baklava was found 25, 30 feet from the main area he was in, no blood on it. A pair of pants he was wearing was found near the scene, turned inside out, no blood, no bite marks on it. The entire area was very similar to what I just explained about McCuller. They found almost nothing of Schleyer other than little teeny bones, a few teeth. That's about it. And the individual that I interviewed from the resources group in the Yukon said, Dave, first of all, bears in the Yukon don't eat their victims. They may attack them, but in 35 years, I never remember a bear actually consuming somebody to this point. The other point is that they found bear scat in the area. It was tested. There was no human remains in it. And there was no clothing in it. So Schleyer's coat was gone, his gloves were gone, his shirt was gone, his pants were there, his boots were gone. And it was one of the biggest whodunits in the Yukon's history. And the more important point And initially, people will say, oh, you know, a bear ate them or something. But there was food at the campsite that wasn't disturbed. And the resource guy could not say that it was a bear. He said, Dave, I don't think it was a bear. But I don't know what did do it.
You had another, you have a mention early in the book about a highway or a trail of tears kind of a place in British Columbia.
Yeah, I talk about it briefly, but I don't cover it. British Columbia, you and I could sit and talk about it for 8 hours and never cover everything adequately. Right up through the middle of British Columbia, there's a highway that's been nicknamed the Highway of Tears, and there's 50-plus Native American women that have disappeared. And the RCMP kind of poo-pooed the whole idea for a number of years until public sentiment got to the point that they had to do something about it. And they started, now they have a RCMP task force working it, and they essentially have very, very little information about what's happening. They disappear. They're never seen with anybody. They're gone, and the numbers are phenomenal. Coupled with that, they have another disappearance going up there where feet inside shoes are showing up on beaches. And I know that they have only one case out of probably a dozen where they've identified the person. The other people, they don't even know who they are. And I'm talking about a single foot washes up on a beach with a shoe on it, and that's it. And for the people in California, actually one of these shoes with a foot in it rolled up on a beach in Crescent City not too long ago. Not much press about it, and I just heard about it because I was monitoring a site out of Eureka that had something in the news. But British Columbia is very, very strange. I did write a chapter about Vancouver Island. And Vancouver Island has some children that disappeared there and some adults under the most bizarre conditions you can imagine. Again, in the middle of the woods, they're at a cabin. One girl, very young, disappears. She's found days and days later, 1,000, 2,000 feet uphill from the cabin. And the stranger thing is she's found underneath a log. And a lot of these kids are found in a place where the government is flying FLIR, forward-looking radar, trying to get a heat map of something on the ground. And they're never going to find it because they're under a log. And it just defies logic. And the parents on that one case in Vancouver Island, they stated that there's no way my daughter could have gone that way. There's no way my daughter would have walked that far. And there's no way she would ever leave the front of the cabin. She was afraid of her own shadow.
You hear the descriptions that you're giving us about these guys with their pants unbuttoned and their belt down, you know, and then you hear about a bunch of women disappearing and then little kids disappearing. I'm thinking of the first thing that comes to mind is some sort of sexual predator, some kind of a psychopath that abducts people for sexual reasons and then leaves the remains or something. Why do you rule that out? I guess in general.
Right. And you got to think about this in general terms. So for an adult, let's say a Boy Scout, 15, 16 years old, who's 5'10" and 150 pounds, and he's walking with a group and he falls behind, logically, it makes no sense that somebody could forcibly abduct anybody in the wilderness and make them to go anywhere with the number of people on trails, especially the Appalachian Trail where this Boy Scout disappeared. That's a pretty frequented trail. And then to force him down into an area where he would disrobe and purposely do acts that would cause a suicidal result. I mean, this replicates itself over and over and over again, sometimes even with hunters who are armed. So you got to think that can't be the logical end to it. There's got to be something else that is happening here that we don't understand. I don't think an average human is stealthy enough, quick enough, strong enough to force these type of things to occur.
Well, we're going to get into some specific cases that demonstrate that point. We're talking with David Politis about his new book, Missing 411. A lot of creepy stuff still to come. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with David Politis about his new book, two-volume book, Missing 411. Going to stay with Canada for the next couple of minutes and then go down the West Coast. And it's amazing to me, anyway, how many of these cases occur in California. You think of California as very populous. There's people around, but there are some huge clusters in both ends of the state. And we'll be talking about those As we continue our conversation with David Politis, I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. A couple of other questions about Canada. You've mentioned now about the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and I was curious whether the attitude that you encountered with them on working with this stuff is different from what you encountered with the National Park Service here.
Well, Canada has a FOIA similar to us, but it only applies to Canadian citizens, so they don't have to do anything for us. And if it wasn't for archive searches to the max, we would have found nothing. And so, no, their attitude towards the U.S. is negligible. And having my buddies up in B.C. try to work it for me, they ran into worse problems than we had down here.
Huh. There's one case on Vancouver Island I want to touch on because it demonstrates some of the other truly weird aspects of this, and it's a young boy named Yehudi Pryor.
Yeah, Yehudi is again one of these cases where a young boy is doing something that you wouldn't think would be dangerous, and that is he's out in the woods and he's berry picking, and he's with his dad, and they're in an area called Wild Duck Lake, and they're out there just having the time of their lives. September 23rd, 1974. Kid's only 2 years old. He could barely walk. And as the father was picking the berries, he all of a sudden realized that Yehudi wasn't around. And he started looking, started calling the kid's name, couldn't find him. And he started to get more and more frantic, and he started screaming, and people started to come to the area. And before long, the RCMP was there with tracking dogs. They had helicopters. They had everything you'd have in a search. Nothing. And about 6 days after Yehudi first disappeared, a group was in really, really rugged bushland, very, very far outside the search parameters that you would look for a two-year-old, and they found his body. And nobody could explain how he got there. Nobody could explain why he was there. And his dad said there's no way he could have gotten there. And the autopsy said he died of exposure. Now, this is going to be a common theme when you talk about kids who die in the wild. They're going to die of exposure. And a lot of times it's a catch-all for they can't figure it out. And there were no obvious signs of injury. But that's kind of the way it was, and it probably still is for kids who disappear. And there's other cases of kids with their parents berry-picking and disappearing.
Berry picking, as if something is lurking in the berry bushes.
Well, yeah, and the first thought is, of course, okay, well, obviously you're challenging the bear for his place with the berries. But remember, when these kids are eventually found, there's no bite marks, there's no injuries, there's no nothing to them. They died of exposure, and they're found miles away, or they're found across a river, and there's no explanation of how they got there. And in most of these instances, the kid's either dead and can't explain it, two is too young and can't explain it, or three tells an amazing story that's baffling to researchers, law enforcement, and the press probably doesn't put the majority of the story in the paper because it's too hard to believe.
And in this case, with the prior boy, his father's right there. They're very close proximity. If a bear grabbed him, you're going to hear something.
Well, and like I said, this isn't the only time this has happened. If you just go south, and west, or south and east just a little bit, into the northern Cascades, there's a boy named Bobby Pankinen who disappeared in a cluster with other boys about anywhere between the ages of 4 and 9 years old, all within a 80 to 90-mile radius of one location in really, really rugged wilderness area. And in most of the instances, they're doing mundane things. They're berry picking. They're doing strange things. They're not doing strange things. They're just hanging out. Well, this one kid named Wesley Piatote, berry picking with his mom. These are Native Americans. They're in the rugged wild. His mom hears a muffled scream and starts running towards him. She hears a second scream louder, and she starts really running. And now everyone's running. He disappeared. Kid was never found. Now, the way I explain this in the book is a scream is one of the last gestures you're ever willing to make or ever can make before you view it as the end. You don't have enough time to explain, hey, help me, I'm falling. A scream is something abrupt and major, and it's the last thing that they'll usually hear. And there's a couple of these stories in both books where parents hear a scream of the kid and they disappear and they're never found. Now, in the same radius, in the same area, and it's near Wenatchee, Washington, that a lot of these things occurred, a little boy named Jimmy Duffy was in a camper with his sister while his parents walked around the outside of this camper, and they went there for the weekend. Parents are about 200 yards from the camper, and they have it in view. Short period of time, they walk behind a couple trees. They both hear a scream. They run around the outside of the trees. The back of the camper's open. They don't see anything. They run as fast as they can into the camper, and they look inside. The daughter is still asleep, and their cat is still inside, and Jimmy is gone. A massive search of this area, the boy is never found. Now, this is a really interesting case because the sheriff lost the case file, and he put it under his wing, and he worked for weeks, him and another clerk, and they found the case file, and they sent it all to me. And it's now open again, but it wasn't. And the interesting part about this case is that the detectives working it initially accused the parents. And, I mean, they drilled these parents hard. And eventually they got Seattle PD to do polygraph exams on both of them and cleared them both. Now, imagine this, George. You lose your son in the middle of nowhere. You spend the next 2 or 3 weeks defending yourself as detectives are honing in on you. In the meantime, nobody's looking for your son, and your son is never found. By the time you're exonerated, the trail's closed, that's it. And what I'm telling you about these boys missing up north, I guarantee nobody's put this together.
The other thing about the prior case that I don't want to beat a dead horse here or something, but you the body was found in an entirely different valley. This kid's 2 years old. There is no way that he walks all that distance under his own power. It's as if he's like transported or something.
Exactly. And that's an ongoing theme. They're found in areas that don't make sense. They're found outside search parameters. And again, not slightly outside. I mean way outside.
And sometimes found in areas that have been thoroughly searched over and over.
That happens multiple times. Sometimes they're found in the middle of a trail where searchers are going. It's almost as though some intelligent entity puts them in a location knowing that searchers are going to find them. It's like you're gone for a while. Okay, now we don't need you, but now we're going to put you in a place where we know that you're going to get found. And they put you there, and the searchers find them. And then they're baffled. They say, we searched this area 30 times. We go up and down this trail every day. And then they're found, and there's no marks on them per se, except every once in a while, especially in the East Coast edition, the kids are found, and they're scratched badly. And I addressed that a little bit. It happened in Arizona a lot with a cluster of young boys that also disappeared. And in the newspapers, they say they were horribly scratched to the point of almost being gored. And in the newspaper articles, it says, well, it's obvious that they were walking through the bush with no care for themselves. And I said, and I explained this in the book, and I say, you know, a 3 or 4 year old or a 5 or 6 year old, they're not going to randomly walk through needles and thorns and berry bushes and just horribly scratch themselves up. If it gets that bad, I think they're going to sit down and just wait. But I don't think that a small boy or a small girl is going to just randomly walk through this stuff and just tear their body up. That's not the mentality.
Along the same lines, you have several cases in the book where the kids will walk not only an incredible distance, but up. That they, you know, they're lost, presumably, wandering around in the wilderness, and they start climbing a mountain as opposed to going down.
And that's something that initially when I read about these, I thought, well, okay, that's a one-time random occurrence. And I can guarantee that the search and rescue teams that are working these cases never think to even go outside these parameters to the degree that sometimes they have to. And some of the young, it's usually boys, under the age of 5, disappear. And there was a case out of Mono, California, Inyo Kern County region, just outside of Yosemite National Park on the eastern side. A small boy disappears, and him and his family are vacationing with their camper at a region right near a lake. And the kid, they're looking for him for a couple of days, and they bring in some fresh dogs. And this is one of those strange times where the dogs start going uphill. And I'm not talking a little hill. This is a huge hill. And what I write in the book is that as, because I went to this area, and as you walk up this hill, and I'm talking, I walk 100 feet up, but I'm huffing and puffing, and I turn behind me, and I have a full view of the campsite where this kid disappeared, and the lake, because there's nothing on this hillside. It's super steep. So he hikes up at 3,000 feet, but the kid's not done. He goes over the top of that mountain, down into a valley, and he starts hiking the next mountain. And now he's going up 4,000 or 5,000 feet. And the way this was found is a dog actually bit on the trail and started going up the hill. Middle of the night, they stopped, and I'm sure that the searchers thought this is insanity. And that's why they called it the night, and they went back. The next day, they bring in Army personnel to help them search. And an Army sergeant is two mountains, and we're not talking hills, we're talking mountains away near a peak on the outskirts of Yosemite. And he goes around a boulder, and he finds this boy dead laying on the ground. And when the reporter interviewed the soldier, he asked him, he says, were there any visible injuries? And the soldier commented that, oh, I couldn't make a determination on that. Now, you and I know that if we walk up on a body and we don't see anything, we're going to be able to say, hey, there were no visible injuries that I saw. Yet if he were told to just keep his mouth shut and not talk about it, he's probably going to say, well, you know, I really don't know, and I really can't comment about that, which was kind of the statement that the sergeant made. And it was, again, it's one of those cases 5,000 times outside search parameters. The kid was naked. He didn't have any shoes on. Again, no comment about the feet. It's a totally bizarre story.
Talk to me for a moment about cases where the victims, the person that vanishes or disappears, is found alive. I mean, you mentioned several examples of kids who are found somewhere alive, but it seems like the ones who come back are all too young to be able to explain where they were or what happened to them, or they have mental problems and can't express themselves.
And, you know, that is a very strange part of this story, and I talk about it in both books. At the beginning, you start to think, well, maybe these kids with disabilities, because of that disability, disappeared. Because of their inability to think logically like you and I, they disappeared. But when you get into the minutiae of the data, there's too many for it to be a random chance like that. And it's too coincidental that they disappear under the circumstances that they do. There's one case where a small boy, again, disappears. Searchers look for him for days. He's not found. And when he's eventually found, again, found so far outside the search parameters as it's ridiculous, again, found without any clothing. The mom and dad come over. They view the body. And the searchers say, well, you know, he probably had hypothermia and he took his clothes off. This is one of those cases where the parents said, hey, nix on that. My kid couldn't take his clothes off. He couldn't dress himself. So under that scenario, there wasn't one mention in the search and rescue report or in any law enforcement document about how they can reconcile that.
It's almost as if the ones who survive, or at least a lot of the children who survive and are found because they can't talk. It's almost like, well, I can let this one go. He can never explain it to anybody.
And you know, that's what logic would tell you. And somehow or another, whoever, whatever is happening here has some knowledge of what's going on with that person before they take them. It's beyond my understanding. But there's too coincidental, and it happens too frequently for it to be chance.
I'm going to jump out of geographical order here while we're talking about kids, because there is one case in the Missing 411 Eastern U.S. book, a Michigan case that you highlighted and mentioned to me because you knew it would be of interest to me in particular, about this girl named Katie Flynn in Michigan, 3 years old.
That case is one of the most, how would you describe it?
I don't know. It's kind of chilling, and it goes to the heart of a mystery that I've sort of pursued on my own. But go ahead and tell it.
So in 1868, in northern Michigan, near a city called Walhalla, her dad, a guy named Henry Flynn, ran a lumber camp. And his daughter was 3 years old, could just walk, and couldn't walk too well, but she would, up this hill, the dad would get trees and do the milling, et cetera, and then the horses would drag the cart with the lumber down to the bottom of the hill, and Katie would get off, and then she'd run back to the top of the hill for another ride down. And I don't know how many times a day she did this, but she did it a lot. And at one point, the dad went back to the top of the hill, and Katie wasn't there. And this, he started to get frustrated, and he started looking around. And in a very, very odd coincidence, as they're running around looking for Katie, two hunters show up. And everyone's screaming, looking for Katie, blah, blah, blah. And these hunters start helping Mr. Flynn look for his daughter. So as they're searching, they hear this kind of, it was described in the article as a feeble cry inside dense, dense brush miles from where they were. And as they walk up on this little cry, they see what they think is a giant bear jump from the location where Katie was at into the river and absolutely fly through the river and disappear. So when Mr. Flynn gets his daughter, he says, when we were calling you, why didn't you come back to us? And she said, it wouldn't let me. And Mr. Flynn says, well, what do you mean it wouldn't let you? Mr. Wolf wouldn't let me. And he goes, well, what do you mean Mr. Wolf wouldn't let you? He says, what happened to your hat? And he goes, and she says, the wolf ate it. And he goes, well, what do you mean the wolf ate it? He took it off my head, and he ate it in front of me. And he says, well, did you get anything to eat? And he says, and she says, yeah, the wolf got some berries for me and put it in its paw and handed it to me. And Mr. Flynn's a pretty smart guy, just like you and I are really brilliant. Well, gee, a wolf couldn't hold berries in its hand. So, but she was pretty adamant that it was a wolf. And this goes on, and there's a couple different stories over the years that don't wander too far from what was told. But in general, the story is pretty convincing that the way Katie described it probably happened pretty similar to that.
I think in the book you used the term big dog instead of wolf.
Yeah.
That's what caught my attention, you know, dog heads on animals. And a big dog came up to me, took me in his arms, and walked away with me.
Yeah.
And then he also laid down and made a little shelter for her, and they laid down and spent some time there.
Yeah, and cuddled with her and kept her warm.
Not like any big dog or bear I've ever heard of.
No, no. But I don't mind saying it, that I mean, when I was reading this, because I try to read a lot, I mean, that northern Michigan area kind of has a notation for being dogman area.
And yeah, that's true.
And this is kind of falls in line with that, but kind of strange.
I also notice that the Uinta Basin, and we're not going to have time enough to get into it before the break, but the Uinta Basin, which I've been to a lot of times and investigated some other strange stuff, is one of the clusters that you cover in the book, as well as several in California. Maybe we'll just put it this way, and then we'll go, when we hear the music, we'll go to a break. But California, you think of it as, you know, it's the most populous state in the nation. Millions and millions of people. We forget about how vast the state is and how much wilderness there is. And as you document, a lot of people disappear in these areas, both ends of the state. You have clusters at both ends.
That's correct. I mean, the area around the LA Basin has a series of kids that have disappeared in very strange circumstances. You go all the way to the northern sector of the state around Mount Shasta. There's another cluster there. There's a cluster in the Sierras right around Yosemite that some of the stories just defy anybody's conventional explanation of what happened.
We'll get into those clusters in California right after this break. We're talking with David Politis about his new book, Missing 411. Stay with us, everyone. This is Coast to Coast AM.